2008, we now have the brains of over 140 athletes, over 100 of which have turned up positive for this disease, not just football players, ice hockey players, rugby players, boxing, professional wrestling, and some more sports that we're going to introduce this year. And it's not just even athletes, military veterans, battered spouses, epileptics with dozens of falls. This is a disease that we didn't pay attention to, we didn't understand, and now we really have to catch up and confront.
President Alinsky, I want to thank you so much for being with us and for your work. He's a former Harvard football player, former professional wrestler, leading expert on sports-related head injuries, author of Head Games, Football's Concussion Crisis, now co-founded the Sports Legacy Institute. That does it for the show. Juan Gonzalez will be speaking in Houston at the Hattie Mae White Administration Building, 4400 West 18th Street, tonight at 7. I'll be in Santa Fe at the Lenzic. Mark's now produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltzer, Armando Ingram, and Shake Steve Martinez. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
WHFR Dearborn. And now it's time for a public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. It's our local news and views show. Alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area based on the Dearborn Press and Guide, the Dearborn Times Herald, Patch.com, and any other relatively good source that we can find. How are you doing out there? It's another cold day in Dearborn. Winter has returned again. My name is Jay Koronik, and here with me in the studio is our WHFR News Director, Dennis Reimars.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I'm glad you started with that, because it leads into the fact that I have a head cold, and I hope it's not a flu, although my granddaughter has had a cold flu that she went to the doctor even 2 days ago. She's been home from her daycare school for the last week, and so there's probably some germs or viruses floating around my house right now.
You told me that you were, and we won't mention any names because we don't endorse necessarily anything here, but you were taking a little concoction and up until about 3 days ago, and that's when this thing nailed you, right?
Well, yeah, patent medicine is good, but there's a lot of side effects to things, even prescription medicine.
Sure.
So, I'm taking a little elderberry syrup.
Okay.
Yep. Sambucus, whatever, European thing. And that's supposed to help your immune system. But once you get a cold, there's not too much more you can do. You could take more of it if you wanted to. But, so I'm holding my own. But I start getting choked here, your show.
Yeah, I was going to say, folks, be prepared to hear my voice. I think it's funny, though, these people that talk about these wonderful can't-miss cold remedies. And whatever it is, there's a variation of different things that you ingest or different movements or rest or whatever. And mm-hmm. then after a week or 10 days, you'll be fine. Mm-hmm. Well, let's hope you're fine anyway after a week or 10 days. So I think the rest is the key. We'll get you out of here as fast as we can.
Well, I'm going to be around, but I think the point is my voice may not hold. So let's use your voice. There's a big story from last Sunday's Press and Guide, and you know, folks, we are broadcasting from here at Henry Ford Community College, and all the opinions we express are not necessarily those of anyone here at the college. But as a breaking story, we probably have to cover it for you, so you're aware. First of all, our tuition is going up next year by 7%. That was voted on by our Board of Trustees in the last week or so, 10 days ago, I guess. And give us that story, Dennis.
Well, it's interesting. Right in the first paragraph, this is HFCC hiking tuition to balance budget by Kadri Hetrick. Henry Ford Community College expects to raise tuition rates about 7% next year as it looks to balance the budget and tries to control costs related to students milking federal student loan programs. And I think that maybe the single biggest thing here. Now, this article, and I won't read the entire article. It's very long, very in-depth. It covers very well both – I won't say just both sides, all sides of this story to make it extremely balanced. But the ultimate reason, it seems, that the school is forced to in this position is based on people taking Pell Grants and initially not even showing up at all. They would go to – not necessarily even go to class.
Explain what a Pell Grant is, Dennis. Well,
thank you. Sorry, Pell Grants are do not have to be repaid. They're unlike student loans or they're along the lines of what would be considered a scholarship, but it's based on need. It's based on financial need. And that being the case, they don't have to pay these back, and they can be these grants can be up to $5,500 per year for students.
Yeah, and they come from the federal government.
This is a federal government thing. Right. But if a student doesn't, you know, qualifies for the grant, uses the money for school, but doesn't go to school, the school's on the hook for paying the money back to the federal government. Now, the school can then go after students for the money, but that is a very difficult process, and they have to track them, and they have to, again, I mean, you're talking about it would be a civil thing where they could sue them. But you have to, I mean, suing somebody for the money and collecting are two different things. Anyway, they're in this situation now, and as we read from the article, it's very difficult to track the students. They have a number of different things that are being considered, so this doesn't happen in the future. But I'll get to that in just a second. Initially, or early in the article, they talk about the tuition hike. Right now, it's about $75 per student in district. That means people in the city of Dearborn. That will go up to $82 per credit hour. And let's stay right here. I mean, that's still very competitive. I think that actually would put it right around the same tuition as Schoolcraft College for in-district there.
And probably similar to Wayne County Community College, and it, within a couple bucks one way or the other.
Sure. And then, and again, they're talking about that's in-district. Non-residents would see tuition rise from $135 to $142, while out-of-state and international students would pay $147 per credit hour as opposed to $140. And then, again, they said this increase is needed to cover what otherwise is expected to be a $7.5 million deficit next year. That's according to our one of our vice presidents here, Marge Schwann. She said total expenses for next year are projected to be $72.6 million. And there's actually Trustee Mary Lane did rally against the proposal increase. And she said, we're trying to get more money out of fewer people, which is, I mean, that's very true because we reached our peak here, I think. Would you say last year, Jay, as far as tuition or as far as enrollment?
Yeah, there has been a decline in enrollment, but Mary should know that in the last 5 years, we've never had more people. Like the average over the last 5 years is thousands of students more than we've ever had here before. This is my 45th year here at the college as a teacher in some capacity. And we've never had that many students. Of course, we have more buildings to put them in now, you know, more desks, more seats, more class space, more parking lot space. But, you know, and this college, we're primarily run not on state funds, not on federal funds, not even on local millage, which is only about 17%, I think, of our total budget. But it's on student tuition and fees. And so a decline, even of a couple thousand, does make a big difference.
Sure.
But we still are getting so much more money than 4 or 5 years ago. You have to look at other places in the college where there's been cuts. John McDonald, representing the teachers union, the full-time teachers union here at the college, which is only 220, approximately 220 full-time teachers, compared to about, I think it's 1,200 to 1,400 part-time teachers.
It's an incredible cost savings right there, isn't it?
Yeah, and the college has refused to allow even replacements for the last 4 years of full-time teachers. And certain departments, if you don't have at least one full-time person who really knows what they're doing, has a lot of time to manage all of the part-time people, to hire and manage them, your program is going to go away.
Sure.
We have many art programs, many specialty programs, where you have one great lead teacher, like telecommunications with Susan McGraw there.
Sure.
Without that full-time position, you just can't have the classes because there's equipment, there's labs, there's hiring, as I said, supervision of all the part-timers. And so this is just penny-wise, pound foolish. I've got several others, and other faculty here have spoken, too, of suggestions. And I know some made the comment at the board meeting and others afterwards through emails to the board at this meeting, is that unlike our usual system of shared governance over here, we haven't been really asked to participate in a creative way. And I think we're fairly smart as a group.
Yeah.
And we want great instruction. We want efficiency of budget. But, you know, if they don't give us a chance, and in fact, as McDonald mentioned, too, the full-time faculty have taken pay cuts of 10% over the last 3 years.
Right.
So it's not that we're not doing our share here, and in no way should the full-time faculty be blamed for the budget overrun.
Well, Mary Lane's big argument against the tuition hike is that she said over the last decade there's been a 45 – and this is higher education overall. There's been a 45% increase in tuition, but only a 25% increase in inflation over that same period. And, of course, what you've just said fills in a lot of the holes. There's a lot of things that aren't taken into consideration when you're talking about strictly inflation.
Yeah, it's not a simple story, just like our national budget or deficit spending or whatever. It's a complicated story, but there are answers, and I'm kind of upset after 45 years that the full-time faculty, who are really smart, believe me, my colleagues are really, really knowledgeable, and in the past, we have found cost savings and cost cutting that did not hurt instruction. For example, every one of my I was head of the telecom area for 10 years from 88 to 98 in the last millennia. And in each year, yeah, I was getting like 10 or 15% budget cuts for supplies, equipment, and of course telecommunications. You know, we're heavily computer based and video cameras and
technology.
Sure. You have to have that. But I found ways of improving instruction either with grants or with special purchasing situations with certain vendors that would give us, you know, discounts for larger quantities. So I was able to play that game for 10 years, and I think our budget reduced 75%, not for instruction. You always need good teachers, but, you know, and that's because I was smart. I did a lot of research. I did a lot of phone calls. And by the way, I had no release time. That is no extra time to be a department head, which I think was wrong. So I put in about 70, 80 hours a week for my so-called 40-hour salary, and in addition to teaching a full load of classes every semester. But that's the kind of dedication you get from somebody who is respected, a professional who's smart and really serious about education. And almost all the full-time people here are like that. They would put in 80 hours a week for just the regular base pay if they could be allowed more participation and respect in the morning. And that board meeting, a lot of the board members, I mean, they're not full-time. I'm sorry, no disrespect to the board members, but they're not. They get the full-time title, but they don't spend more than a couple hours, I assume, before each meeting and in prep or reading over the minutes and notes, and they're not always on campus, and they're not going to all the internal meetings and that. And so they don't really know the full picture most of the time. So I do recommend, as you did, Katie Herrick has done a fantastic job of documenting the very extensive and significant discussions back and forth, pro and con, throughout the evening. This is one of those stories where, this is from last Sunday's Press and Guide, the 27th mm-hmm. of January. You need to read it, folks, all the way through. Not just say, well, I read the first two paragraphs, and that's like every story in a newspaper. That's like the summary. And then I'll know everything I need to know. No, you really don't unless you see all these issues back and forth. And Katie is not writing opinion here. She's just trying to do a good job of reporting all the statements. And you know, we're not that far in the hole. We're not going broke here at all. But, of course, energy costs go up and, you know, we had a budgeting change in the last couple of years, too, that John McDonald mentioned at the meeting, and that is that our new science building addition, actually a whole new building that was attached to the other one and changes in the old one, our parking lots from a couple of years ago that were completed all around the college, that was $12 million, $15 million project for that. Unlike the past, they used to have a separate maintenance and construction budget or a separate bond issue, and the decision was made, oh, we'll just use the general fund. Well, those are expensive buildings, and outfitting them with, science, technology, oh my God, not just, the dead frogs for the biology lab, but, we're talking about computers everywhere and high-tech equipment of all kinds in science, of course, you'd expect that. And so that's one reason that it looks like we're a little bit down in our budget. But some of these almost draconian answers, anti-education answers that were mentioned at the meeting, and I'm not saying exactly who, but you can read the article and find out, are obviously need to be shouted down, need to be argued away, because that has nothing to do with anything. One of the things that they pointed out was, according to the way they look at things usually, our graduation rate at Henry Ford Community College is the lowest of all community colleges in Michigan. however, it's crazy. First of all, it doesn't account for the students that disappear, like those Pell Grant fraud people.
Pell runners, they call them,
sure. Right? It doesn't allow for students that start here and then transfer.
That was my question.
So they're not getting a degree. They just transfer. So that's
not fair. Well, they're
not
technically graduating. The only ones that they call graduates are the ones that apply for graduation.
They get an AA degree. And I don't even know if a certificate counts as graduation. That probably would.
I would think so.
1 year, 1.5 year certificate in some specialty area.
Sure.
And the article explains that. The board said, oh, you only got 9%. What's wrong there? and people in the audience and McDonald and others, they explained it.
Yep.
It's complicated, and the way that those numbers come up don't really mean what they mean. And this has always been the case for community colleges, especially when looked at by some of our state legislators who are really distant, mentally distant, from community college administration.
Oh, right, right.
They say, oh, we're not going to give you any money. You only graduate that small number. But look what it means. Look what it means. And look at the on the other flip-flop, what's the quality of the people who are graduated? I mean, that's really hard to define.
Right.
I mean, supposedly the degree, everybody with the same degree is of equal intelligence and ability.
Well, of course not. You'd have to follow people for quite a while.
We are well known for our high standards.
Sure.
If people get a 2-year degree here at Henry Ford Community College, they usually have no trouble at all if they transfer to a 4-year school. I mean, that's been documented by study after study that we've done following up them at that next institution.
Well, back with this, the tuition hike, if you listen to Board Treasurer James Schoolmaster, he said the one issue hurting the college, like we talked about, is the federal loans, misuse of federal loans. That's not really true. I wouldn't call it federal loans. It's the Pell Grants. And he said that 20% of tuition revenue will need to be returned next year because students never really attended or failed all their classes. That is fraud. And I remember, and we brought this up before a couple of years ago, when I was with the Mirror News, the newspaper here, when all this was going on and the federal loans at record highs, we asked some people, and we were told that it was something they couldn't talk about at all because there was an ongoing investigation. In other words, I was led to believe in these terms that you will know when our investigation is over because it will be big news, it will be in the papers, and yes, I was told I would be in on it. But that never happened. This is, I think, what we're finding out now is that it's so difficult to track these students. If the students leave here, let's say, and some of them, as the article points out, are kind of savvy, they'll show up for the first week or two of classes until those refund checks are cut.
Yeah, there's actually 10 days in a counting point. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's explain what that is. What happens is somebody applies for financial aid. They get the Pell Grant. Again, that's a grant that does not have to be repaid, but it's used for tuition and books. They get this money. Whatever is not applied to school, in other words, the school takes their tuition, their fees, and everything right off the bat, as well as you can use books in the bookstore. Anything left over, let's say your Pell Grant is for $2,500 and your tuition and books equal $1,500. When that period of time is over with, you'll get a refund check cut to you. And it's not cash. It's a check for $1,000. Well, a lot of people are going to school, apparently. The fraudulent part comes, they go to school just for that check when they really had no intentions of following through on school. So they go, and the savvy ones go for that period of time, like you said, the 10 days or whatever it is. They get their check, and then they're never heard from. Then they apply the next semester at maybe OCC, Oakland Community College, or maybe another one, Monroe, or wherever, and do the same thing.
Yeah, the article does point out that that's one way they found to play the game, because unfortunately the colleges are not, there's no big database,
no registry
of college students that we can easily compare from semester to semester in a prompt sort of way. I mean, there's ways of sending the names of our disappeared students to another college, and then probably with similar low number of people in their enrollment office, they could look it up maybe months later, but that would be too late to prevent that fraud again. I mean, it's not going to – don't take notes here, folks, and say, oh, I'm going to be a Pell runner. That's going to be my career. It'll catch up to you rather fast.
Absolutely.
I don't think you could do it more than once or more than twice, really. And then, of course, you have no college degree. You have no education. So
– what, do you get a couple thousand dollars?
Yeah, a couple thousand dollars. Enjoy it. One big party? Is that it? You know, a trip to downtown Detroit Casino or something? That's foolish. Absolutely foolish. If you're – as I tell some of the students who think they're clever when they try to cheat and I catch them, not many that that happens, but I have caught, I think, all that tried, but you never know. If you're so clever, why not just get an A in the class? I mean, why spend all that time and effort and craftiness in setting up a situation that you have no benefit from, except in this case, maybe a couple bucks in your pocket, where in the long run, you get the smarts, you get the degree, you can get better jobs. I know there's a lot of people with four-year degrees who are out of work. A lot of them are teachers, too.
Yeah.
But... You know, there's no real excuse for this kind of cheating. I mean, we're here to improve ourselves, and you don't get improved by being a con person. Very, very few con people can last very long. And guess what? It's illegal too.
To
do fraud.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, on top of everything. Yeah, I thought that was a given. I'm sorry. I was just looking at the information regarding they said that these Pell runners are hurting the bottom line regarding graduation rates. But they also, as Mary Lane asked the question, she says, I'm throwing this question out there. If we see someone who has a fifth grade math level, do we admit them? And Dr. Mee, the president of HFCC, said that was a sticky issue. She said, quote, historically, community colleges have prided themselves on open access. But they, I'll pose this to you, they don't necessarily let just anyone in, correct? I mean, just because you have the money.
Well, we have placement standards in terms of reading and writing. And so if somebody comes to us with very poor reading and writing and math skills in their first semester, I think at least two of their classes have to take care of you know, the first step, wherever it is in the sequence that they need, of reading, writing, and or math. And then they get another optional choice. And my problem is, and so they are enrolled, they do get the Pell Grant, and then they can disappear. But we try to let them know that if they don't have writing and reading skills that are at the college level, they're going to fail most of their classes, even those that don't have a so-called prerequisite.
Right.
That there's no way they can succeed in college without first improving their reading and writing skills. And so one proposal made there was to have an academy, and you don't want to call it remedial academy or dummies school or something.
Prep.
But, yeah, and don't let them out of there until their reading, writing, and math skills are high enough that they can be somewhat guaranteed, not perfectly guaranteed, of having entry-level abilities in all the classes at the college. Of course, when you do that, you're creating a whole nother institution of schools,
right,
not just here, but... Because the high schools, I'm sorry, folks, are not doing their jobs. And middle school before them, elementary, of course. And why not? They don't have the money, they don't have the teachers, they don't have the facility. But it looks like if these kinds of things keep happening, I mean, I've seen many students that they're in remedial English, remedial math, remedial reading, and they try to take even our staff training class.
Right.
Well, we have a handbook.
Mm-hmm.
And we have another handout on FCC rules. and we talk about them in class. I lecture on them. But if they can't read very well, they can't remember, and they can't understand what they've read.
Right.
And so they're going to fail the final, and they fail the little one-credit-hour class. I mean, a one-credit-hour class, you know, and they'll fail it just because a counselor said, oh, it's just radio. Or Susan McGraw, she teaches film history. Someone said, oh, it's just movies. I go to class and watch movies. I'm bound to be able to pass that class.
Yeah.
No, they write film criticism.
Right.
They have essay exams. Because movie watching adds to critical thinking, and you need to write critically to prove that you learned something. Duh. So that I'm just saying every class here has reading and writing requirements, and if you're not at college-level reading and writing, if your high school didn't do a good job. Now, you say, well, how many high schools get you ready for college? Most don't. Most, if you've got at least a 10th grade level,
right,
sophomore, you know, 2 years away from graduating, that's usually okay.
Well, that'll get you by, because as Dr. Mee says, she answered my question. She said that the only time they'll refuse a student is if you call them remedial, but I think the actual politically correct term is developmental. The developmental classes, yes, that they have here, which are all pre-100. So if you're looking at a class that says English 80, that's a developmental class, whereas right, English 131 would be not.
And you'd be placed in those based on the test scores on admission.
And yeah, some of those are pass or fail. They're not even graded, right, depending yeah on how low, how developmental they are. But as you move up, like you said, yeah, now Dr. Mee states here that if we don't have a developmental class for that person, then that's the only way they wouldn't be introduced to the college.
I think it's a low percentage, something like 5% of the people that are admitted here to the college, and they mention that they want to take science or math or something related to that, they take the math placement test, and the 5% have to start, and I kid you not, in a class called arithmetic.
Right.
It is adding, subtracting, multiplying, and dividing. I'm not kidding you.
And I know, and it's really not funny, because, at least this is a starting point. So, I mean, I'm looking at the positive. You're trying to see a silver lining.
And developmental is not just one class for those people out there. We get some people who, their English reading and writing ability, we let them in because they have a high school diploma,
right,
from usually a local high school. It might take them 3 to 4 semesters of 6 to 8 classes, developmental classes, before they can even take the first semester of English composition, mm-hmm, English 131, as we call it.
Right. The old 101.
So that's like a year and a half or 2 years, and you're not even, I mean, you get a few of those no prereq college classes that you're going to do poorly in,
right,
that you can take at the same time. So that's very frustrating. You know why a lot drop out? Because they see themselves in classes that are not going to count towards graduation.
Exactly.
And won't transfer to a four-year school. But guess what? They need to improve those skills if they're ever hope to have a higher educational success.
The academy to which you alluded earlier is they're talking K through 14. Kindergarten through 14 years, would be 2 years after normally people would normally graduate from high school. And then at that point, those last 2 years would bring people up to speed to be able to go step right into a college program, yeah, ideally.
Right. But, you know, we'd have to dedicate a whole separate group of buildings to it, or repurpose several of our buildings on campus, because this is like 40, what is it? How many students come here needing developmental classes? I think it's more than half.
62%.
Yeah, 62% need developmental English and reading classes, even though they have high school degrees.
It's 62% in reading, 68% writing, and 89% in math.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's okay. All right.
Yeah, that's scary. Okay. Well, we do have an editorial, maybe before we feature Jim Hightower. Dennis would look it up here. It was in the Times Herald this last Wednesday, January 30th. And, of course, for whatever reason, they picked their editorials from other papers that are part of their maybe group.
Right.
Livingston Daily Press and Argus.
And Argus. Yeah, this is the guest editorial is, Why doesn't Michigan Republicans' case for Rhodes add up for schools? And I'll start at the top. Governor Rick Snyder and many of his Republican allies in the legislature think it's plain as your nose common sense to invest in Michigan roads. It's not wise to save money by skipping oil changes, only to risk a major expense when your engine freezes up, they say. Similarly, they ask, why not invest $12 billion over the next decade in order to avoid a $25 billion road bill down the road? But if that reasoning is so obvious to them, one must wonder why they can't see the same value equation when it comes to public education. Hober roads are certainly a negative in Michigan. If the governor's information is correct, the situation will only get worse without additional funding. The current level of funding is insufficient, according to administrative spokespeople. But these same people are silent when it comes to making the same argument for public education, an area where funding has been cut since Snyder came into office. While the state's infrastructure is legitimately an area of concern, it's possible to make a stronger argument on the importance of adequately funding public education. It's not only an investment in the next generation, it's also a force for business attraction. Business recruiters for the state tell stories of prospects who won't consider Michigan until they are assured that there will be sufficient qualified employees to hire. Money, or more money to be precise, doesn't guarantee improvements in either education or roads. Even if more money is provided, it must be used wisely to be effective. State leaders seem to accept that premise when it comes to education, but are less dogmatic about it when it comes to roads. The plan now being pushed by the Republican leadership would force an increase in user taxes. Gasoline taxes and vehicle registrations will qualify under that, to provide additional road funds. Once accomplished, the Republicans want to seek a May statewide ballot issue to see if voters prefer the user tax hike or would prefer to see a higher sales tax to pay for roads. There is no option for, quote, none of the above. If voters don't support a higher sales tax, then raising the user tax will be the default position.
Yeah, we don't have a date for that May election?
No. Just May.
You know, that's the first time in this article that I've read about that. Maybe it's not finalized by the legislature.
It can't be.
How much is it going to cost them to have a special election in May? I thought there was a rule, no more special elections. It always had to be in November from now on.
Well, this is the plan, quote, being pushed by the Republican leadership right now. And they said that they would, once accomplished, they hope or they would like to see the May statewide ballot. Yeah. So this is all what they would want.
You know, of all the areas, and of course I'm biased because I've been a teacher for 45 years, and I know the value of a good education, not just for myself, but for my many students who have come back and given me feedback about the quality of their experience here at Henry Ford, and not just my classes. But for Pete's sakes, folks, the number one thing that's going to need funding, both locally and statewide and federal-wide, is our schools, is education. Now, I really believe in a lot of local control, but I think there needs to be standards set and recommended by intelligent people with rationale that's given out so everybody understands why you want to recommend this or that kind of program. You know, the Dearborn schools are having a different kind of placement test, too. They're going to be called Common Core test, replacing the MEEP. Tests, and those are going to be more challenging, but probably those are tied in more to goals that the students should be learning too. So we'll see where that goes. In terms of roads, sure, we know Michigan roads are always a problem. As I said last week about that, it's been years since we ever invested in any sort of light rail. Now they do have a bunch of money that's going to be spent on maybe some light rail in Detroit and some increased speedier bus lines.
So what is that, almost like a trolley in a sense?
Well, they're not going to have overhead trolley.
On the streets.
No, it's actually a way that they can have express buses, first of all. You know, there might be some light rail. I don't know where that's going to run. I know they're talking, as you know, Dennis, from connecting Pontiac by rail to the train station in Detroit,
right.
And or the one in Dearborn, although I don't think we have any tracks
they
here.
They don't talk about that yet.
No, because, you know, who wants to go to Pontiac right now? I mean, but right. There'll be stops along the way. But, no, the express buses actually, some people thought it'd be crazy, but they would have special lanes, and they wouldn't stop every street, but they would get you where you're going a lot faster. Now, you could ride a local, or you could ride an express, depending on where you want to get off.
Right.
You know, it's sort of like some expressways are like that, too, or even around the Detroit area.
Sure, Southfield Freeway.
You stay off on the right if you want to get off quickly on the local, and then it's actually divided, and you can you can go faster and more continuously because there's not people constantly trying to get off and get on if you stay on the
express
part of it. So it's kind of like that with the buses. And legislature put up, was it $200 million or whatever for that? And that's a great idea, you know, and setting up the regional transit authority.
Well, that was part of the $200 million, wasn't
right,
it?
Yeah.
Okay, right.
Yeah, it's all part of the plans there. So.
Just to round this off, this guest editorial basically said that the voters, if they have a say, they should get to choose not just from those two options, and maybe they get to choose whether that money goes to the roads or to the schools. That's a really interesting prospect.
Yeah, Yeah, what has anybody ever done that before? That, you know, it doesn't have to be even no matter how they vote. I don't think it's going to be forcing the legislature to take that path. I think it's only advisory.
Exactly.
Oh, and well.
There's nobody gets the choice.
You heard it here first, folks, on the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views. Here's a couple of comments from Jim Hightower, our friendly populist commentator out of Austin, Texas. He asked the question, is there such a thing as corporate governance? And also, what about tax deductions for these big corporations? What do you think he's going to say? Take a listen.
Wall Streeters are all a-Twitter about the comeuppance of Jamie Dimon, the haughty CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase. Last year, poor Jamie presided over a $6 billion loss by the bank's chief investment office. So he's now had his own pay cut in half, knocking him down to $11.5 million. I suppose that's really a come-downance. But by whatever name, having his paycheck whacked by J.P. Morgan's board of directors is widely viewed on Wall Street as a harsh rap on the knuckles. But ask about the board's actions? Dimon himself merely said, "I respect their decision." Of course he does. He walked away with his job intact, an $11.5 million wad in his pocket, and a sly grin on his face. Indeed, many investors and bank regulators, not to mention us commoners, don't consider that level of, quote, punishment to be much of a deterrent to the kind of executive narcissism and carelessness that characterizes today's Wall Street elite. Yet, members of the bank's board are actually puffing out their chests, claiming to be bold bank directors. The vote to cut Dimon's pay, they say, shows that by gollies we're an effective take-charge watchdog over the top management of the nation's biggest bank. That they can even say something so absurd speaks volumes about the laissez-faire myth that corporations don't need government regulation since they have private boards that oversee them. Who are J.P. Morgan's directors? Lee Raymond, for one. In fact, he heads the board's compensation committee and took the lead in giving Dimon his haircut. But Raymond is congenitally gentle on CEO pay because he was a lavishly well-paid corporate chieftain himself. As CEO for ExxonMobil for 13 years, his paycheck totaled $686 million, $144,000 a day. This is Jim Hightower saying, corporate governance is a joke.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Can't those constantly complaining consumer advocates ever be satisfied? The government extracted a $10 billion payment from a dozen major mortgage lenders as punishment for their unlawful eviction of homeowners, yet consumer groups say it's not nearly enough. Come on, $10 billion is real money. Well, yes, for you and me, but for Bank of America, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, and the eight others, $10 billion is not even 0.001% of their revenues for 1 year. And it's certainly not enough to make these 12 scofflaws go straight. Moreover, as pointed out by alert consumer watchdogs at U.S. Public Interest Research Group, there's another tricky hickey on this deal. The IRS is allowing the banks to treat the payouts to wronged homeowners as a cost of doing business, meaning the banksters will simply deduct most of the $10 billion from their corporate tax payments. Yes, that means that we taxpayers are being made to subsidize their, quote, punishment. Angry about this coddling of criminals, Republican Senator Chuck Grassley said the government is abetting the bankers' behavior by not preventing the deduction. That's unfair, he added. Well, yes, as well as morally despicable and scummy. Also, unnecessary. Federal agencies have the authority to stipulate in these settlement deals that the price of bad corporate behavior includes the violators having to foot the entire penalty, with no portion of it passed on to taxpayers. This is Jim Hightower saying, having that authority, government has a moral responsibility to use it, both to protect our public treasury and to make such legal settlements punitive enough that a corporate wrongdoer will hesitate to repeat the violation. To see the Consumer Group's report on stopping these taxpayer subsidies, go to www.uspirg.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
You're listening to the Friday, February 1st edition of the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views right here from WHFR.fm, the station making waves from Henry Ford Community College. My name is Jay Kornick, and with me is Dennis Reimars to continue with our stories of the day. I have to say, since I mentioned February 1st, February 3rd is a very, very big day. It certainly is. Hear that music? Real impressive. That's my phone. Yeah. Turn that off. But what?
I'm not on.
Oh. Dennis wants to talk.
Yeah.
No, but I wanted to say that Sunday, what is Sunday, Dennis? February 3rd, but yeah, what is Sunday? What's
it that? It is the 10,000th day of broadcasting for WHFR.
Yeah. 10,000 days of broadcasting. Isn't that amazing?
That's hard to wrap your head around. 10,000 days.
That's why my voice is in such bad shape.
Yeah, that's
10,000 10,000 days of talking right in a row. Well, yeah. You know, we had a couple days off the air totally because of power outages back in 2003. That was just a little bit over a day. But we subtracted that, folks. We're not, you know.
We're not going to inflate the numbers.
The real 10,000th day. And, of course, we're in our 28th year. We've completed 27 years of broadcasting, non-commercial, independent, alternative variety music that other stations don't play, but maybe they should, and news, local news. Nobody gets as local as we do over radio or TV in this area. So,
has anybody been a part of the station for consecutively for as long as you have? Has Susan?
I mean, that's not physically possible, but no, I've been the advisor since 1976.
Oh, when it was a club.
36 years, right? 37 years now. Yeah, went from when it was a club. So that's it, yeah. Mm-hmm. Let me turn these things off.
So no, we're not turning into a music show, folks. Jay's showing off his... Anyway, so you've been here longer than anybody. I mean, really, and that's just by...
Well, just by accident. No, but as I said, I've been teaching at the college for 45 years and in the telecom department, and it just became obvious that the club needed an advisor at one point. The previous advisor died. Yeah. That's how tough it was. I was lucky enough to talk to the right people and actually get a chance to apply for the license. And we won the license in 79. We got on the air in 85. And the rest is history, as they say. So I'm very proud of that. In Detroit, we don't have enough non-commercial stations that actually play music because it's really good music and give you news and information because we really believe it matters. You know, it's not just a press release from some department and we're just going to read it because they want us to, or because we're already running commercials from them. So, what we say is what we want to say, and what we play is what we want to play. And we thank Henry Ford Community College for allowing it to be that way. But every city needs a lot more non-commercial media, and they need more support.
And so everybody that was hanging on my every word after Jay asked me what Sunday is, I know you were expecting it Super Bowl Sunday.
Yeah, who cares about that?
But I got to tell you, there's a lot of people that do not really get into it. I mean, more people than I expected do not get into the Super Bowl festivities, and this tuning into 89.3 FM here is not a bad alternative. So,
nope.
I want to jump right in. What does the name, and I know the name Helping Youth Progress and Excel, HYPE, what does that mean to you?
Well, it's obviously Hype Athletics.
We've been talking about this. This has been going on for quite a while, and you know, we report it as it comes on. We'll actually advance this story, but we had an opportunity to meet the founder, CEO, and He's the founder and CEO, 32-year-old Ali Sayed. He was actually on the show.
Wasn't he running for city council?
He was running for council at the time. Mm-hmm. And he was, at that time, he was maybe 28, 29 years old. Really sharp individual. Well, he went on. At the time, he was starting. He was just launching Hype. And it's become sort of a big deal in Dearborn Heights. But as we've been reporting now for a while, the city says he owes, and this is three times now that they've sent him a tax bill. And it's in excess of $200,000. And he says, no, I'm a nonprofit. I do not have to pay this. Mayor Poletko went out on a limb in this story here, and I'll read this.
And this is because even though Hype Athletics has an office in Dearborn, this new facility, this huge recreational facility, is in Dearborn Heights.
Dearborn Heights.
So it's sort of a Dearborn Heights-based operation right now.
That's exactly right. He's worried that Hype is facing nearly nearly $200,000 in property, real and personal tax bills that he says it shouldn't owe because it is a federally registered nonprofit. The city of Dearborn Heights disagrees and has sent the three tax bills. And Mayor Dan Poletko said Monday that it's not up to him or the city council to determine if an organization can even receive these property tax exemptions. He says it's not a political decision. It's a decision I can't grant. So basically, he's saying, look, you fill out the paperwork. If it's done right, everything's in there, T's crossed, I's dotted, and it turns out you're a nonprofit, then so be it. Up until now, that has not been the case.
Yeah. Unnamed experts that I've talked to over the last couple of years, I mean, there's been rumors, but rumors from people that know taxes and criteria for qualification to be a nonprofit, have at least questioned that status for Hype. And so it is not just something that just came up in Dearborn Heights with the mayor there, the way you operate your organization, okay, you get a nonprofit status, but it doesn't mean you can do anything you want to after that.
Right.
And there are some things that you would do that might disqualify you. For example, WHFR, we have a non-commercial license from the Federal Communications Commission. We cannot do commercials. Why? Because we're not allowed to. Okay? That's the kind of license we wanted. We wanted to do more public service. We wanted to do, you know, spend less time in commercials. Sure, we don't have an easy way to make money here. We have to ask for it in our annual pledge drive. Or maybe have you show up at our benefit concerts, the next one coming up a week from tomorrow at Joe Vaccaro's Andiamo Italian Steakhouse.
You got it. Nice segue, by the way.
Yes. Same location as the previous Andiamo Dearborn right there on Michigan Avenue. But it's going to be a great evening from 7 to 11. That's a week from tomorrow night. I'll play the little announcement we've pre-recorded at the end of the show. If you want to come, and it's just $5 admission.
$5.
If you wanted to get food or beverages while you're there, you can do that.
Three bands.
That's right. Three jazz bands. Sort of Dixieland, Mardi Gras theme a little bit, but I don't think we're not throwing beads or having a parade. But
No.
But still.
Anyway, back to Hype. You're right. There's different. You have to protect your nonprofit status.
Yeah. So I think at some point he'll need to go to court, or they're just going to take his property away from him in order to prove that he has operated as a nonprofit should over these last years. So all these issues that have sort of been rumored about ways that he has not properly acted as a nonprofit will come up again, and it'll be worked out in court. So I'm not saying, you know, rumors happen all the time. A courtroom is the place to once and for all end the discussion.
Well, right now it's in front of, it's before the Michigan Tax Tribunal, and I don't know how definitive that would be, because that's not a court, is it?
Well, they act like, I mean, they review evidence on both sides, but I think if he disagrees with that, he may be able to sue again.
It's probably an appeal process. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sure there's usually appeals, but I'm not sure. Maybe not.
Well, he did say if this does go through and he does, in fact, have to pay these taxes, he'll have to lay off, or the Hype will have to lay off 15 of the 57 employees and cut some programs. Yeah. It says like free after school tutoring.
Yeah, his business model. Well, just to pay the back taxes, his business model is such that he won't, even if he became a for-profit entity, he'll have to raise user fees and so on from now on. But the problem is he's going to be $200,000 in debt to start with if he can't win this argument. So we wish him well.
Absolutely.
If he seemed like he was, you know, sort of filling the need. If you folks remember Adrie Appliance, and Louise Adrie just passed away 2 weeks ago. I mentioned that last week. Mike Adrie's wife, And they were great supporters for like four decades of local athletics. You know, keep the kids off the street, organize them into basketball teams, baseball teams, what have you. And they play in a lot of the local parks that we had. And ADRIG would pay for all the equipment and the uniforms. And that was really wonderful. That was great community payback from ADRIG Appliance. And he was well-respected. A lot of people supported him as a local business person just because of that connection to the kids of Dearborn.
Yeah.
Without ADRE, and finally they didn't have money enough, their operation didn't have enough cash flow, as they say, because they were outpaced by the big box appliance stores, which is too bad. But, you know, if you can get an item at significantly less money in a tight economy, you probably go to Walmart or wherever, and you Best Buy, whatever, you get your stuff there. And
did you ever buy anything from ADRE?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
And they were experts, weren't they?
In fact, if it wasn't for their support in the early years, we wouldn't have WHFR.
Really?
Now they did what's called underwriting for us. We actually mentioned their name and said thank you. Not commercials, but their financial support secured WHFR on the air in those early years. Along with, I should mention also, the Ford Motor Company, surprisingly, that they supported us for the first 5 years because they wanted to use our broadcast signal, what's called a subcarrier, something you couldn't hear over FM, for their own test of their own radios. And we worked out the deal via our consultant at the time, who was also a consultant for Ford Motor, and their advanced digital audio department actually used us as a test bed for a lot of their real-world tests for their own car radios. So they got something out of us, just like ADRE did, but it was wonderful that those relationships did happen, or we wouldn't have WHFR established the way we did and be able to continue on to where we are now. So we'll follow that for you, folks. We'd want to say that there has been no final decision about this, but there's always been that question in the background, that rumor hanging over hype among those that had heard the rumor, and I think it's let's put it to bed. Let's get it resolved one way or the other. Either it's a nonprofit, and therefore it shouldn't have to pay those taxes, or it has been operating as a profit making institution, and Mr. Saeed will have to restructure his business plan and see if he can still survive.
And he did say, you know, just to put things in perspective as we wrap this up, his HYPE's annual budget is $1.4 million. So $200,000 is substantial.
That's what I said. It would if he has to pay that right away, unless they give some sort of payback. I mean, if he's found not to be a nonprofit these past years, it's really going to it could actually put him out of business.
Absolutely.
So we'll see how that goes. As Jim Hightower said, all these other companies, for-profit companies, are getting tax abatements and tax exemptions right and left. Okay, his business is only 1.6, you said?
1.4 is
there. 1.4 million, but that's significant. That's, you know, anything over a million looks like a fortune to me.
Yeah.
So I'm easily impressed, I guess. So I don't know what the taxes for Dearborn Heights are, but they'll lose those taxes if they can't stay in business.
That's a really good point.
Of course, he doesn't want to pay taxes. That's the point. If he's a nonprofit, he isn't to pay property taxes.
Right. There's so much to this. And again, like you said, it's probably will end up in court.
Well, it's got to work out. Okay. Now, what we found out just today, in fact, from Patch.com, if you have that, is there's been two candidates who apparently already have, this is candidates for Dearborn City Council, that already have their applications filed.
For those seven open spots.
Right, for the seven open spots. And, of course, in November there's going to be the final election, but if there's more than 50, if there's 15 or more that have applications in, there will be a primary to narrow it down to, I don't know, 12 or 10 or something on the November ballot. So there'll be a primary in August if there's, I think, 15 or more.
Twice as many candidates as open positions, right?
A lot of people have already heard rumors, and it was in the paper, that at least four of our council members may not run again. And, of course, you never know until the deadline, May 14th, because they might decide to run again at the last minute. But I've heard rumors, strong rumors, that four will not run again. And one of them, Tom Tefelsky. Did I get that right, or is it Ted?
No, it's Tom.
Tom. I got it right the first time. I keep calling him Ted.
Or Tim, yeah.
Or Tim, yeah. I'm sorry.
But Mr. Tobolsky.
If he would get here to be interviewed on this show, we've invited him time after time. Maybe I'll get his name right. I think it's a little subconscious thing that I got. Oh, anyway, okay, Tom. He has been spoken for by others, and he said he might be interested in running for mayor. Well, because his term is up in November, he'd have to choose, sort of like Janet Battelow, who we interviewed last week, a Dearborn Heights Council person. She expressed that she was going to proceed to try to run for mayor in November. Well,
it's all or
you
nothing.
Can't run for two at the same time, you know, so she had to choose. So if she doesn't, if she does run for mayor and she doesn't win that contest, then she won't be in Dearborn Heights government.
She's out of a job, she says.
Yeah.
That's right.
Right. And the same thing would go for Tobolsky.
Yes.
If he chooses to go for mayor, then he can't run for council at the same time. And he has been the highest vote getter of all council candidates. And that's why he becomes president of the council by that happening.
So our current mayor was.
He certainly knows that he has support enough to easily be one of the top seven again.
Sure.
Since he was the top candidate for the last couple of elections. So he is risking quite a lot to run against a mayor who is still pretty popular, even though there's been some issues.
Well, that's, and I was going to say that, wasn't the mayor, he was the top vote getter when he was on city council.
Yes.
Which is why he took over for the mayor when Guido passed away.
And, okay. But he's pretty certain, therefore, if you're the top vote getter for council, you get a significant good number of votes, maybe not enough to win, but that's pretty good evidence that maybe you could win.
Yeah.
You know, if you choose the higher office. Well, two people who have already apparently filed their petitions. One is Michael Albano, who we've had on this show.
Sure.
And he has an editorial we might be able to comment about briefly before the end of the hour. And the other is, that's the wrong page. Okay.
There it is.
I got it. We read the papers on the air, folks, in this show.
Not necessarily for the first time, though.
No. Colette Richards.
Yes.
And I haven't met Colette before, but Colette Richards and Michael Albano, if you want to know more about them in person, they're going to be at Park Place.
A little meet and greet.
Yeah. From 5 to 6:30 next Monday, February 4th. Park Place is located on Park Street. In
Makes
West
sense.
Dearborn. Well, it's a banquet hall facility, and it doesn't say there's free food, so don't count on that. But you want to talk to these two? I mean, I think there's going to be quite a few. It's going to be more than two. We know that at least I signed the petition, which doesn't mean necessarily I'm going to support anybody, but just to get them on the ballot. Maureen McElrath of Going Green Foundation.
There's five people that have done this, and they're all in there.
Oh, okay.
Yep, absolutely.
But they're only these two that are going
to
be.
Those two are doing the meet and greet, but then there's three others that have also applied for the
city
council.
That's right. It's got her name there at the end. Read through to the end, Cornick. Maureen McElrath, Robert Bochenek, and Mohammed Barrow. That's
okay.
What it says, B-E-R-R-O. They've also pulled petitions, which means they took them out. They haven't returned them yet. You only need 100 signatures, valid signatures, by May 14th to run for office.
Heck, if you have an extended family, you know.
You can run for mayor, and there is already one gentleman who's running for mayor. He's already put the petition in.
Right.
Can't remember his name now, George someone, I think.
So what Albano was saying and what I read there is not only is this a chance for people to get to know him and obviously this Colette Richards, but also he can get some feedback from some of the people as well. So I think this is a wise move, and I don't think it's too early either. I think it's, what day is it? Next week?
Monday. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
Monday, 5 to 6:30 p.m., Colette Richards and Michael Albano are going to be at Park Place. So now he has in the paper, just as reference, and we only have only 3 minutes left before Highway 61, Best in the Blues, is scheduled with Joanne Kay. Scorecard for parts of Dearborn's 2010 master plan. Albano has written an editorial opinion. It is in the Wednesday, January 30th Press and Guide. And he reviews 9 parts of the so-called Dearborn 2010 city master plan. And especially the desires of respondents. One very important page. It was a survey they did.
Okay.
And I think I was in that because the number one desire for the city was increased walkable and bikeable connections.
Okay.
And of course, I'm in favor of not just recreational biking and walking, but actually for transportation,
sure,
for reliable movement back and forth. And that's not even in the plans now. But so, first of all, it's not things that Dearborn promised to do. It's just this is part of it was in that master plan that this is what the people of Dearborn wanted, and these were the priorities in that order. It's only a representative sample, of course.
Yeah, he set up a task force, didn't he? And he got this, and this was the master plan.
I said representative. I don't think it was chosen because they didn't choose me. I just went online and put my vote in. So
it
wasn't necessarily even representative, these things. But he goes through, and you should read it because it's not just on page 6A, but it's also on 7A too, and he goes down point by point and he gives grades. He admits they're just subjective,
sure,
unofficial,
and he also admits that some of them are premature. If the actual whatever if the city follows through on a plan, then it would go up to a B or an A.
Like better recreational options, he gave them a B, just because it's not really bad, and we have built some new tennis courts and near Tenike.
Yeah, over there, yeah. Two brand new ones.
And a new Dunworth Pool Splash Park opening this season.
Let's hope Dunworth
Splash
Pool
Splash Park. Yeah, well, no good without the pool, I guess. But but everything else he gives a C and a D to. D. Okay. Oh, no, I'm sorry. B also for city does a better than average job of making sure homes and businesses stay well maintained.
Yeah, there's a 3-inch thing on the lawn.
Boy, there's a lot of people online on Patch.com saying that we're not enforcing the building codes enough.
Well, they don't have enough ordinance officers.
Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah.
You know what, Dearborn? So, feel lucky, Dearborn Heights.
He doesn't mention in this article here, but certainly you could say, of course, if he wants to get elected, he has to have a platform.
Sure.
And he here is supporting things supposedly people want. And he's also saying, by his grades, whether they're accurate or not, Dearborn hasn't done very well.
And needs to improve.
Right? Yeah, and needs to improve. So these would, we assume, would be his some of his priorities if he did choose to run. And he has. He's already done that. So I guess you could criticize this as kind of self-serving if you knew he was running. And he really should have mentioned that as part of the article.
At the same time,
They did for him, though.
Right.
The newspaper put at the very end, he has pulled petitions to run for Dearborn City Council.
Okay. And how many of these in the future do we see from other candidates? Because, let's face it, the pressing guide is looking for content.
Yeah. Express your opinions all you can. Get them out there. Get response from people and let people know where you're coming from, not just a pretty face.
He's not low profile. Like you said, we've had him on this show, and I see him about out and about, especially at the farmer's market. So, there's opportunities, I think, for any candidates to get their face out there and get their message out for people to follow.
Mm-hmm.
You got something there?
There was a message from the Dearborn Police Department on my phone. That was one of those things that was ringing, you know. But
wow. Okay.
I'm in trouble now.
No, I doubt you are.
Oh, reminds residents to drive safely during winter weather conditions.
Well, that's nice of them.
See email web message for further. This is, you can subscribe, you can go to cityofdearborn.org, subscribe to, under police department, to Nixle, NIXLE.US/85FHC. There's a link anyway if you want to get these messages coming to your phone. I find it's, I just want emergencies, and to remind me to lock my car, remind me to be careful when it's snowing outside with my driving, I think that's a little unnecessary, at least for me. So I don't really, I'm thinking of canceling Nixle, but I know that a few big emergencies, like remember the accident on I-75 yesterday that was on all the news last night.
Incredible.
You know, I think they said it was I-75 and Springwells.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I see Joanne's on her way in, so let's quickly just two things before we
go. Right,
we've
got to wrap up. It is WHFR Dearborn, folks.
One of them is that we were going to talk about the possible merger between the fire departments, Dearborn and Melvindale.
It's still possible.
It's still possible, but it's not any closer or further away.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and I will say Dearborn Heights and Garden City is in the exact same boat. So we're hearing more about it, but it's the same, more of the same. And then you want to talk about the DSO?
Well, right. The Dearborn Symphony Orchestra tonight at 8 p.m., they're going to present in the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center, Great Movies, Grand Piano.
All right.
Meaning it's a big piano, but also it's going to be played in a very grand way.
Sure.
Rich Ridenour,